Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times by Bernie Sanders, "Democrats Need a Wake-Up," and look into the apparent bewilderment on the part of Democratic Party officials that while Bernie Sanders has made it clear he will vote for Hillary Clinton, he has not yet endorsed her. Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for New York Magazine and the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, joins us to discuss his latest article at New York Magazine, "Will Either Sanders or Trump Ever Give Hillary Clinton the Satisfaction of a Concession Speech?" and Senator Sanders' warning that Democrats should pay attention to the Brexit vote and a similar underappreciated anger in the American electorate over income inequality and trade deals. Then we'll speak with Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. He joins us to discuss the alarm amongst the big Republican donors at Donald Trump's escalating attacks on trade deals that Moody's Analytics reports will, if enacted, cause a recession, if not a depression. With the three amigos, the presidents of Mexico and the U.S. and the prime minister of Canada, meeting today to celebrate NAFTA while Trump is trashing it, we will examine the growing rift between Trump's populist economics and the big money that is expected to finance his presidential campaign. Then finally, we'll look into today's votes in the U.S. Senate, 2 days ahead of Puerto Rico's defaulting on its debts, and try that by a wide margin would allow the island, which is still considered a territory where its people are U.S. citizens but cannot vote, to restructure its $72 billion debt and create an oversight board to monitor Puerto Rico's recovery. Andrew Hanauer, the campaign director for the Jubilee USA Network, joins us to discuss how the vulture funds who have been financing a deceptive ad campaign will not be wringing the last dime out of the island at the expense of the health and welfare of its people. And joining us now is Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for New York Magazine and the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and his latest article at New York Magazine is, "Will Either Sanders or Trump Ever Give Hillary Clinton the Satisfaction of a Concession Speech?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
And it's sort of like, you know, what was that? It's sort of like the Rodney Dangerfield with Hillary Clinton. I can't get no respect. I mean, you know, she's the first, likely to be the first president of the United States. She won pretty handily the primary and won very handily here in the state of California. And yet it hasn't, the moment has not happened that, oh my God, you know, we may have a woman president at last. What do you attribute that to?
Well, in Bernie Sanders' case, and he may ultimately concede, I've just raised the possibility today that he'll sort of skip over that, even if he endorses her and even campaigns for her. He's just invested a whole lot, and his people have, in the idea that her victory over him in the nominating contest is tainted, you know, by close primaries or voter purges or any number of things that have sort of developed into a conspiracy theory for many Sanders supporters. So I just have a feeling that he may never get around to acknowledging that she beat him fair and square. And a lot of his supporters don't believe that she did. So I could actually see him campaigning for her without ever really conceding the nomination contest. And in the case of Trump, well, you know, there's never been a conspiracy theory that he didn't greet avidly. So if the general election is anywhere close to being a real contest, I suspect you'll find some reason to delegitimize her victory.
Well, the idea that the somehow the vote was stolen in California, I think, has always been overplayed and completely misplaced. I talked to people involved with, you know, former registrars and others, and there was no conspiracy within non-NPP voting. The real issue is, you know, I voted, and I was I. They sent me the postcard from the registrar. They sent me the voting guide with my name and address on it, and I went to vote, and I had to write out a provisional ballot. I wasn't on the rolls. The real conspiracy is that our entire voting in this country is screwed up. You know, I don't think you could.
Question about that, but it has nothing to do with Bernie Sanders.
Exactly, you couldn't organize a conspiracy because the places the voting is so screwed up in the first place.
Well, in California right now, when it comes to what happened on June 7th, the biggest issue is that people don't quite realize that we've got a nonpartisan top two primary for every race other than the presidency, but then we have a, you know, partisan presidential primary, and that just confused an awful lot of people who didn't quite know what kind of ballot to ask for or why they were voting in a Democratic or Republican primary for president, but then voting among 36 candidates for the U.S. Senate. That's the system that California voters have imposed on themselves. So it has really nothing to do with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and the Bernie people are really grasping at straws and trying to pretend that it was somehow aimed at his candidacy or robbed him of victory.
So let's turn, Ed Kilgore, to Bernie Sanders' op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times, "Democrats Need to Wake Up." He's arguing that we should be looking, and particularly the Democratic Party, should be looking at the Brexit results in the sense that they indicate a groundswell of anger at wealth inequality and bad trade deals. And that's exactly what Trump has been campaigning on. And do you think his warning is well taken?
Well, it was kind of typical Bernie Sanders in that he reduces every human problem to economics. You know, the Brexit vote was partially about economics, but it was heavily about culture. It was heavily about immigration from Eastern Europe, and then the separate phenomenon of non-white immigration into the UK, which has nothing to do with Europe, but has a lot to do with the vote. So, no, they were not voting against trade deals, and they were only partially voting against perceived and real economic inequality. You know, anytime somebody rejects a big institution like the European Union in a referendum, you can point fingers in a lot of different directions. But it's very characteristic of Bernie that he boiled it all down to income inequality, and I just don't think that's true. And it misses an important lesson for Americans who are worried about Donald Trump, because his message is not just about income inequality and trade deals. It's heavily about culture and immigration. And frankly, the cultural panic of older white Americans who don't like a diverse country.
Well, I think that was really also what Brexit was ultimately about.
You didn't hear Bernie talk about that.
Right, yeah. But I mean, when Bernie says we need to fundamentally reject our free trade policies and move to fair trade, Americans should not have to compete against workers in low-wage countries who earn pennies an hour. We must defeat the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We must help poor countries develop sustainable economic models. I mean, the president himself, after the Brexit vote, said, you know, this has everything to do with people's disquiet over the effects of globalism. So what should be the argument here? Because you don't want all of these white working class people in this country voting for Trump, because he's going to take them for a ride, and he's promising them the kind of Powerball equivalent of a political reward, but all the rewards will go to him and not to them. So what are the Democrats supposed to do here? I mean, they can't...
I'd start by making a bit of a qualification. The white percentage of the population in the United Kingdom last time it was measured was 87% or 86%, I believe. In the United States, it's significantly lower. We have a more diverse country. The Labour Party in Britain is heavily dependent on white working class votes. The Democratic Party in this country has been losing the white working class regularly since 1980. You know, there are only so much you can lose in that category of the electorate, and I think thanks to Trump and to Sanders, we're all obsessing about it just a bit too much. Secondly, obviously, globalization and even trade agreements have been a really, you know, difficult, bad, disruptive thing for a lot of folks in traditional industries, manufacturing industries that in any kind of globalization scheme are going to migrate somewhere else. The bigger issue is not whether Democrats attack that. It's what prescriptions they have for dealing with it compared to Donald Trump. Donald Trump's prescriptions for dealing with globalization are, you know, range somewhere along the spectrum that goes from, you know, fantasy to disaster. He would deliberately launch trade wars with China, Mexico, God knows who else, try to intimidate them into a different trading regime. And if that fails, we all go to hell together, I think. There's really nothing that Donald Trump is proposing that's going to do much for white working class Americans. And I do think Hillary Clinton needs to talk a bit more about that, too.
And again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a political columnist for New York Magazine and the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunes. And his latest article at New York Magazine is, "Will either Sanders or Trump ever give Hillary Clinton the satisfaction of a concession speech?" Let's turn then to the apparent sort of puzzlement or bewilderment amongst Democratic officials trying to figure out what Bernie Sanders' endgame is, given that he has said that he will vote for Hillary Clinton, but he has not endorsed her. But he also said, by the way, that he understands math. I think he knows that he's lost. He's not certainly not encouraging his followers to keep beating the dead horse about votes being stolen in California. But what's your sense then of what Bernie Sanders' endgame might be?
Well, you know, he said all along that much of what he wants is a progressive platform for the Democratic Party. His own appointees to the platform committee, for the most part, appear to be pretty happy with the deals they've already cut. I think the areas of dispute remaining still include whether Hillary Clinton has to go for a uniform national $15 minimum wage as opposed to having a little bit of a wiggle room, and whether she's willing to, you know, support a single-payer health care system as opposed to leaving that a little bit open. And there may still be a bit of an argument over the carbon tax. I guess the question is, how far does Bernie really want to push this? He's succeeding on most fronts in helping shape the Democratic platform. I am positive they will give him all the glory he wants at the convention if he plays nice. So, you know, I think we may see a sudden kind of reversal by Bernie as we get closer to the convention when his leverage is pretty much gone. So I wouldn't, if I were a puzzled or baffled Democratic official, I wouldn't panic just yet. But at some point, Hillary Clinton needs to pick up the phone, call Bernie Sanders and say, okay, that's it.
Well,
the train's leaving the station.
But hasn't the Clinton campaign been using Elizabeth Warren as a surrogate to sort of ease the pain in the transition, if you will? I mean, she's been out stumping. And that's, I think, kept some of the Bernie people in the fold, hasn't it?
I guess so, though some of them say it's an insult that she's talking about Elizabeth Warren as a running mate rather than Bernie himself, which ain't happening.
Well, neither of those are realistic possibilities. So.
Well, I think the Warren thing is a realistic possibility.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I publicly endorsed the idea myself. So
yeah, but wouldn't
maybe,
the...
maybe I'm biased.
Yeah, but wouldn't the Massachusetts governor, who's a Republican, appoint a Republican senator?
And that as Harry Reid has himself publicly acknowledged, and he's endorsed Warren for vice president, by the way, the peculiarities of the Massachusetts special election law mean that she could announce an intention to resign. It would trigger a countdown, and you could wind up having a special election before the new president or the new Senate takes office, and you don't lose a thing. So I think that's sort of the general feeling about that particular problem, which still does afflict other potential veeps who are from in the Senate and from states with Republican governors like Sherrod Brown or Cory Booker. So I don't think that's really an issue anymore with Elizabeth Warren. I'm not predicting she's going to be the vice presidential nominee. I'm not 100% sure she wants it. But in the end, after they get over their hurt feelings, I do think Sanders people would be happy with Elizabeth Warren on the ticket.
But it's just a fact in this country, Ed Kilgore, that 60% of male Americans vote Republican, 60%+ female Americans vote Democrat. So there's no advantage of having two women on, either, is there?
Well, it kind of, I think it might help with, say, college-educated white women in terms of maximizing the Democratic percentage against Trump. To double down, I don't really see it's going to cost any votes. The kind of men that are going to vote against a woman, two women on the ticket are going to vote against one woman on the ticket. I don't think it matters. And, you know, as I keep pointing out, I forget the numbers. I've added it up myself. We've had, you know, about 125 major party tickets with two men. It's about time to have one with two women. And I think a lot of women will see it that way.
Right, but back to my earlier question, just in closing, Ed Kilgore, that, you know, the whole idea of the big bounce of Hillary getting the nomination and being the first woman that could become president of the United States, it just seems to have dissipated. And I know for decades the Republicans have been trashing the Clintons, and they've been very successful. They've associated her and her husband with scandal and all kinds of stuff, much of which didn't pan out. In fact, most of which didn't pan out. The only thing that panned out was Monica, and and they tried to impeach him over that, for God's sake. So it's just as an odd thing that I noticed an awful lot of Democrats have sort of joined in that Republican refrain that there's something wrong with her. When if you've been trashed so relentlessly for so long by the Republicans and their propaganda outlet like Fox News, you know, we know the propaganda works, you know. So do you think she can ever kind of somehow get ahead of this, or is she always going to be mired in all of that?
Well, you know, you could weave all sorts of theories about what this would be like if she was running against somebody other than Donald Trump. But the fact is that on his best day, Donald Trump does and says 15 things that are worse than anything anybody has ever alleged that Hillary Clinton has done. So she's gotten very lucky in terms of her opponent. And, you know, for the most part, the Clinton scandals that Republicans are, and some Democrats or some mainstream media are still talking about, really only matter to people who have already made up their minds. Right now, I'd say that Hillary Clinton, Nate Silver of 538 made his initial projections today and said at this moment, Hillary Clinton's about a 70% favorite to win. I think that's about right, and I think it might get a little bit better after the conventions.
And indeed, Hillary Clinton should hope and pray that Donald Trump lasts all the way to November, because that's still a question in my mind. I thank you for joining us, Ed Kilgore.
Anytime, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a political columnist for New York Magazine and the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. And his latest article at New York Magazine is, "Will Either Sanders or Trump Ever Give Hillary Clinton the Satisfaction of a Concession Speech?" We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Donald Trump's attacks on trade deals are upsetting some of the big Republican donors.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. round. Money makes the world go round. It makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
Is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author most recently of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Full Employment and the Democratic Platform, Hillary Can Fix What Bill Broke. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And Dean, what do you make about this, the idea that you've got the three amigos, the President of Mexico and the U.S. and the Prime Minister of Canada meeting today to celebrate NAFTA while Trump is trashing it? And then, of course, you've got these big Republican donors who are expected to finance his presidential campaign, basically, terrified by what he's saying. And Moody's Analytics are now saying that if Trump's anti-trade and economic plans were adopted, there would be a global recession, if not depression.
Well, it is kind of fascinating. Trump is what he is. I mean, I'm sure you've heard plenty of bad things about him. I'd probably disagree with almost none of them. But, the story that somehow his trade policy is going to give us a global recession, depression, it's close to nuts, and it's, I get a little more than a little annoyed at this because it's like this stuff is sacrosanct. You can't talk about it, you can't criticize it, or we'll get a Great Depression. It reminds me back in 2008 when we had the TARP. We had all these people running around, oh, if we don't pass the TARP, we'll have another Great Depression. I asked many people, oh, please explain that to me. How is that going to give us 10 years of double-digit unemployment? And invariably, they'd start mumbling because they didn't know what the hell they were talking about. And these are policy people. I don't mean I grabbed the bus driver. These were people who do policy, economic policy for a living. Same sort of thing here. I'm not going to advocate running out and imposing tariffs on everyone. That is foolish policy. But the idea that that's going to give us a Great Depression is close to nuts. I mean, I could probably come up with some story, but it'd be very far-fetched. We put up a huge tariff and China gets real upset and they put up an even bigger tariff and then we put up an even, you can tell kind of nutty stories, but does anyone actually think that would happen? So, the idea that we're going to get, global depression, no, that's silly. Might this be bad policy? Sure. But we're doing today, when they celebrate NAFTA, basically they lie. Let me just put it as accurately as possible, because I was just on a panel with someone yesterday, and they said, oh, NAFTA's been great for Mexico. It's had great growth. No, it has not had great growth. That's not even a debatable point. If anyone ever tells you Mexico has great growth because since NAFTA, right off the bat, that person either has no clue what they're talking about or they're just lying, because it's just not true. There's no ambiguity. We have good data on that. There's not like another data source that shows Mexico's had great growth. It's had very bad growth. Now, someone could say, would it be even worse without NAFTA? Possibly. But it's not been some boon for Mexico. You simply can't tell that story. Anyhow, I've been going on a diatribe here because, I hear this stuff and it gets me going. But the point is, we should be able to have an honest discussion about these policies. And this running around, oh my God, end of the world, Great Depression, that's intended to prevent an honest discussion.
Well, indeed, the joke in Mexico with Vicente Fox, who was the first non-pre-candidate president of Mexico after NAFTA, the joke was that Vicente Fox promised us 10 million new jobs. The only problem was they were all in the United States. Because there was a vast exodus, as you know.
Well, more likely in China. That's really probably where Mexico's been seeing the biggest loss of jobs to, certainly not the U.S. But NAFTA has been, a source of downward pressure on wages in the U.S. I'll be the first to say a lot of people exaggerate, the negative impact. I mean, that hasn't... It's not the reason we've had wages stagnate for the last 35 years. And by far, it's not the most important trade story. China dwarfs, NAFTA. Although you might say that NAFTA, or I would say, NAFTA did lay the basis for a lot of policy going forward. Basically, the point of NAFTA was to make it easy for U.S. corporations to move their operations to low-wage countries, and they've done that, you know, and that the predicted, sometimes go, oh, we didn't expect, no, the predicted effect, trade theory, if you get an economist to sit down and be honest with you, they'll all agree. You know, the point is to put our workers in competition with low-paid workers in Mexico and other countries, and it drives down wages here. You know, that's the textbook. So when that happens, it's not as though, oh, it didn't work as we expected. That is, at least anyone who knew what they're talking about, that is what you should have expected.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author most recently of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Full Employment and the Democratic Platform, Hillary Can Fix What Bill Broke. So I don't know that you know, Trump will get elected. The polls indicate, and our previous guests mentioned, that Hillary Clinton's incredibly lucky to be running against this guy. But you never know. You know, people were surprised by the Brexit vote. But assuming, you know, that the wrecking crew doesn't happen here in the United States, you've already seen what's happening in Europe. So what is is there a trend here that these big trading blocks will unravel? I mean, TPP seems to have ground to a halt. It's not going anywhere. You got criticism of NAFTA, which we've been discussing. And I don't know, do you think the EU is going to unravel?
Good question. You know, first off, I would say TPP's dead. I'd love to think it is dead, but, you know, we'll see. I don't, these things have a way of coming back, so I wouldn't assume it's dead. The big risk that many people see is a lame duck session. But in terms of, you know, Brexit and the EU, you know, you can point to a lot of the sentiments of the people who voted for Brexit. Clearly a lot of racism, nationalism, xenophobia, all that clearly played a very big role. But the fact was, people have not been doing well economically. And my guess is that if you had seen, you know, good economic growth, people were experiencing rising living standards, they felt good about their economic situation, you wouldn't have seen an urge to leave the European Union. We didn't see that 15 years ago when, you know, economies were doing pretty well. And my hope is that you could see a little reexamination of policy in the European Union. Here I'm thinking of, you know, the Eurozone. You know, the UK had austerity not because of the Eurozone. They're not in the Eurozone. It was their own government. You know, one of the big issues was the National Health Service. They're saying, oh, if we didn't pay this money to Brussels, we could spend on that. Well, you could spend the money on the National Health Service anyhow. They had no constraint there. But the rest of Europe is largely constrained. So Italy, of course, Greece, France, all these countries are being restricted in their ability to boost their economy, not because there's some intrinsic law or, you know, the economics. You could look at that. Their interest rates on their long-term debt is close to zero. Germany's, it's negative. You have to pay them money to lend to them. They should be spending more money boosting their economies. And you sort of go like, well, maybe this could be a wake-up call. I mean, what do you have to do with these people? You know, and again, I'm going to pick on the Germans here because they're the main villains. You just go, what on earth is in your head? You know, the markets are trying to tell you, borrow money and spend it on improving your infrastructure, putting in clean energy, retrofitting buildings. I know they're already way more efficient than the U.S., but they can be much more efficient still. And, you know, this is the time to do it because you have, unutilized labor, unutilized capital, and, you know, people are getting upset. So, you know, if Germany cares about the European Union, they would, you know, change course and say, okay, enough austerity, time to stimulate the economy, time to let economies grow. But if, you know, they're just going, oh, no, we don't give a damn about, you know, reality. We have our beliefs about God knows what they get from Grimm's fairy tale. I don't know where they get their economic views, but it has nothing to do with the economy. If they're going to insist austerity, 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 well, then they probably will break up with the European Union. And guess what? That will be good because you'll have sane economic policy instead of economic policy driven by people running on fairy tales.
But of course, Dean Baker, when you talk about investing in infrastructure. That rings a bell here in the United States with interest rates at near zero for so long. It would have been the perfect time to invest in infrastructure here. And the package you mentioned, TARP, earlier, I mean, if Obama had gotten, had asked for more and gotten more, I think the recession would have ended a lot quicker. And it is puzzling to me why it is that the case can't be made for investing in infrastructure, and also, frankly, for doing what happened during World War II, which is to create those victory bonds, in this case, some kind of government savings bond, because the people in this country, and particularly seniors, have nowhere to save. Banks used to pay interest. Now they charge interest. You have to basically go into 401ks, which are subject to the vagaries of the market. We've seen it go like crazy in the last few days since Brexit. So do you think that if Clinton came up with some kind of plan for Americans that they could actually save money and have a retirement fund and not be subject to the stock market? And would that resonate, do you think?
Yeah, I think it would. Just to go back to something, just to be clear, that the TARP was completely different from
the
stimulus.
Sure, yeah, back at the time of the TARP, I meant. Yeah.
I've had a lot of people confused on that, so I just wanted to be clear. Yeah, I mean, we do need something. 401ks are not working. A huge amount of money is taken away in fees. You know, California actually is moving ahead. I don't know where it stands. I mean, I had some input at various points along the way, but you're studying a plan to have a statewide retirement fund, which I think would be a fantastic thing, where, you know, depending on how it's designed exactly, you might have a guaranteed benefit. So people could put aside, you know, $1,000 a year and know that they'll get, you know, let's say 3% or 4% interest, whatever it might be. So I think there's a lot of support, and I know even, you know, some relatively conservative people, Republicans, who support, you know, if I were to sit down with them and we'd say, okay, what do you want to do? It'd look different, you know, their view would be different than mine, but I think you can come to agreement. So I think there is a recognition that, you know, Social Security is a fantastic, you know, sort of core retirement, but, you know, if you had a middle-class income, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, Social Security is not going to be sufficient to let you maintain that in retirement. We need something else, and 401ks clearly are not cutting it.
So what kind of could you do something along the lines of victory? I mean, they used to have post office savings, which is huge in Japan, by the way. I mean, where you could actually, you know, get a decent return, or not a modest one, but a decent one. There's just nowhere where you can get a return except taking a chance on the market.
Well, to get a higher return, you will have to invest in real assets, but you could, as an individual, you could be shielded from that. That's the whole point of having, you know, like if I have a pension, you know, a traditional pension, you know, public employees tend to be the only people that still have traditional pensions. But those are invested, of course, in the stock market, but me as an individual worker, I don't have to worry that the market's down this year or, you know, maybe they made some bad investment choices, as long as they're doing it competently. I mean, there are cases where, you know, usually corruption. But, you know, if they're doing it competently, they could shield individual workers from the ups and downs of the market, and that's what you want.
You're right, but that's what we used to have. We used to have defined benefits, but now they've virtually gone away, haven't they?
Well, they have. As I say, that's why you need something like, you know, what, again, I don't know exactly where the California state proposal sits, but there was at least one version of that where, in effect, it would be very similar to defined benefit. Defined benefits usually were based on directly on your pay. These wouldn't do that, but they would say, okay, if you're putting in $1,000 a year, you're going to get, you know, 3 or 4% return, and you don't have to worry about the market because we're going to guarantee that. And, you know, certainly a state like California might be a little more difficult, you know, for a smaller state of Wyoming or, you know, Rhode Island or something. But, you know, certainly a state as large as California, it's as big as most countries or bigger, that they'd be in a position to do that. Ideally, you do it nationally. I mean, that would be the ideal. But, you know, just, you know, you're quicker, you're closer to having it there than we are nationally.
Sure. Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Dean Baker, let's talk about the growing rift between Trump's populist economics and the big money that's expected to finance his presidential campaign. He basically doesn't have a presidential campaign. As you know, he went off to Scotland to promote his golf course. And at the time of the Brexit vote, with the market crashing and the pound dropping like a stone, he said that the economic conditions underway would be good for him. While people were losing, you know, all kinds of billions off the market and off pension funds, etc. So, what do you make of these big Republican donors basically alarmed? And by the way, the Chamber of Commerce has come out as well against Trump, which is normally allied with the Republican Party. Who do you think is going to win out? The traditional big fat cats? Because it's obviously Trump drives them crazy, because the way they control their political surrogates is that they control the purse strings. And in his case, he's because he's, you know, he's not as rich as he says he is, but at least he's self-financing. They don't have that leverage over him, do they?
Well, it's actually not clear. I mean, Trump, you know, I've never met the guy, but I can't make sense of him. I don't think he knows what he's doing half the time. When he was in Scotland touting his golf course, he praised the people of Scotland for asserting their independence with the Brexit vote. Now, of course, Scotland voted like 2-1 against Brexit, you know, and it's very likely if the UK pulls out of the European Union, they're going to pull out of the UK. So I don't know what, you know, what he's planning. I don't know whether he's prepared to spend, you know, say $1 billion of his money. He's not honest about how rich he is. I'm sure he's quite rich, but he, you know, everyone says he's got less than the $10 billion he says. So I don't know if he's prepared to spend $1 billion or so, which would mean he needs big money contributors. So my guess is that most of the big money people are basically fine with Hillary Clinton. They, you know, note that they're not bothered. Trump goes around talking about deporting 11 million people. That doesn't bother him. You know, banning Muslims from entering the country doesn't bother him. It's when he talks about trade. I mean, you got to kind of love that. But, you know, my guess is he's going to end up losing probably by a fairly big margin, in large part because he doesn't get a lot of the traditional, you know, Republican money people. And that means that, you know, even with that, I mean, we saw Obama just won twice. But, you know, if you don't have a lot of those people behind you and you've motivated, you know, the Hispanic community, the Muslim community, the African-American community, really get out and vote, also a lot of women who might otherwise be Republican who can't stand the guy, he's going to lose by a very large margin, is my guess.
But just in closing, Bernie Sanders, of course, had brought forth authentic economic populism, and which was in line with his entire political career and everything that he stood for. It's difficult to know what Trump stands for, as you pointed out, and whether it's just a sort of phony promise that you're going to the political equivalent of winning the Powerball. So do you think there's any way that the Democrats can tap into the kind of economic populism that Trump is tapping into, but he's taking those people for a ride?
Yeah, well, this is going to be an ongoing battle. And, you know, again, this is part of the reason why I get upset when I hear people denouncing Trump on his trade and it's going to lead to a depression. Because that, you know, a lot of what he says is nuts. But the idea that we couldn't have different trade deals, the idea that we shouldn't be looking at more balanced trade with China and other countries, that actually makes sense. Now, I have no idea if what Trump thinks makes sense, but when he says that, he's saying things that make sense. And, you know, it's not, I don't like it when you get all these pundits jumping on and saying, oh, Trump's a nutball, he's a nutball. He is. But when he says some of these things, he is saying reasonable things, and I don't want them laughed out of, you know, the debate just because Trump happened to say them.
Right. Well, I agree with you, even though that maybe in the category of a broken clock is right twice a day. But I thank you for joining us, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economic blog Beat the Press and is the author most recently of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Full Employment and the Democratic Platform, Hillary Can Fix What Bill Broke. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the U.S. Senate today finally moved to help the financially desperate island of Puerto Rico surmount its fiscal crisis.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
It taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride.
just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Andrew Hanauer, who is the campaigns director for the Jubilee USA Network, where he represents Jubilee in policy meetings with the White House, Congress, the World Bank, the IMF, and other partner organizations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Hanauer.
Thanks so much for having me.
And of course, Jubilee USA Network is all about the biblical notion of forgiving debt in Jubilee?
That's right. And we got our start winning debt relief, billions of dollars in debt relief for the world's poorest countries. I think really it's more than just debt relief, though. I think the biblical notion of Jubilee and the work that we do with both religious and secular partners is about creating, you know, correct and right relationships in our economy so that we are having an economy that serves all of us, and especially the most vulnerable, rather than just a few people.
But of course, we have generations of young people in our country today that are indentured with student loans. It doesn't seem that the trajectory is going the right way, but we're talking today about a country, if you will, or at least a state, even though they don't get to vote, even though they're U.S. citizens, they don't get to vote. And we're talking about, of course, Puerto Rico, where the Senate finally today passed a procedural motion indicating by a wide margin, 68 to 32, that they're actually going to deal with the issue of debt relief for Puerto Rico, a second vote taking place at any moment. So what's your impression of what the Senate will be doing? Because we know there's been a vast lobbying effort by the vulture funds, as they're called, the hedge funds who've been buying up this debt and hoping to make a killing on it. They've been advertising all over television in the name of poor Puerto Rican grandmothers, but in fact their motives are quite different from the people who might be suffering in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we expect the bill now will pass. As you said, the vote this morning was very very strongly in favor, 68 to 32, to move forward with the bill. And so, you know, now it just needs 51 votes, or 50 votes, really. And so we do expect it will pass. And I think this is really, it's really incredible to think about because, you know, recently as 7-8 months ago, the prevailing wisdom was that Congress really wasn't going to do anything about this crisis. And this is a crisis that impacts 3.5 million American citizens. These are American citizens. And yet the prevailing wisdom, as I said, was that really Congress was just not going to act. And the problem is if Congress doesn't act, if nobody acts, we have just a downward spiral in which Puerto Rico increasingly cannot, you know, not only cannot pay its debt, but cannot fund basic social services for its people. And so the fact that we were, you know, able to get a bill that allows Puerto Rico to restructure its debt, that stops, you know, these predatory vulture funds, as you called them, I think is really remarkable that it was able to get through the House and the Senate with broad bipartisan support in both houses. And I think that's a pretty remarkable accomplishment given where we were just a very short time ago.
So what is the situation with the vulture funds? Are they going to take a haircut? Because all of their advertising in the name of Puerto Rican grandmothers was aimed at the idea that they didn't want to take a haircut. They were, what I guess they were expecting the U.S. taxpayer to bail them out. Is that was that their motive?
It was very ironic because the ads you're referencing, like the lobbying campaign, millions of dollars that were spent by a small number of groups that we, you know, assume own Puerto Rican debt, was based on calling this bill a bailout. The ads were targeted to convince Republicans mostly not to vote for the bill on the grounds that the bill was a taxpayer bailout of Puerto Rico, and that Puerto Rico was irresponsible and shouldn't have such a bailout. The irony is that this bill is really the only thing that is preventing a bailout. If Congress doesn't pass this bill, then the only options left are, virtually do nothing, which is not an option, or some sort of bailout, which, as you said, would bail out Puerto Rico, but really bail out the people who own Puerto Rico's debt. What we really need is a comprehensive solution that really protects everybody, protects legitimate investors and protects Puerto Rico's people, protects the pensions and spending on hospitals and schools. And I think that's where we need to get to. And I think this bill doesn't do that by itself, but it gives Puerto Rico the breathing space it needs to get to that point.
So can we then rest assured that the people of Puerto Rico are going to be rescued from this terrible situation they're in, and that a bunch of vulture funds are not going to reap the profits? But, I don't know whether at the end of the day there is a structural plan in place, because it's still pretty hard to understand how a country could have gotten that deeply into debt. So walk us through those steps, if you will.
Sure. And this bill certainly does not a magic pill that's going to solve all these problems. When we first started working with Puerto Rico's religious leaders on this crisis, those leaders laid out a series of basically pillars of what a real recovery would look like. So yes, debt relief is necessary, because Puerto Rico simply cannot get its economy out of, what is really a death spiral if it doesn't have some form of basic debt relief or debt restructuring. But in addition to that, we need to stop austerity. The religious leaders called for increased budget transparency so that Puerto Rico's people have a greater say over the way that their money is used. They called for increased participation by Puerto Rico's people in economic decision making, and they called, as you've mentioned, for a halt to vulture behavior. So this bill is not going to by itself rescue anything, but I think what it does is it now allows Puerto Rico and its creditors to sit down instead of fighting each other in court. It allows them to sit down and try to negotiate a settlement that allows Puerto Rico's economy to grow again, which is in everybody's interest, really. So no, folks won't be able to make a quick buck by buying up Puerto Rico's debt cheaply and then suing. But hopefully everyone can work out a solution that is mutually beneficial.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrew Hanauer, who is the campaigns director for the Jubilee USA Network, where he represents Jubilee in policy meetings with the White House, Congress, the World Bank, the IMF, and partner organizations. And we're talking about the Puerto Rican debt relief measures that have cleared a Senate hurdle today. At the end of the day, though, Andrew, my understanding is that one of the reasons why that Puerto Rico gets into this kind of situation is the fact that it's in a sort of constitutional limbo. The citizens of Puerto Rico are American citizens, but they are not allowed to vote. And my understanding, the real reasons, the subtext, if you will, behind the resistance to Puerto Ricans being allowed to vote, which would then mean that they'd have representatives in the Congress and two U.S. senators, is largely that the expectation would be that these representatives and these senators would be Democrats. Is that what's going on here? That it's at the end of the day, wouldn't it make sense for these people to be real American citizens and with the responsibilities and rewards that U.S. citizens have, rather than being in this kind of political and economic limbo?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that Puerto Rico's status has been a contributing factor to the economic crisis. I think the representative for Puerto Rico in Congress, who is, as you mentioned, not able to vote, on the House floor said, you know, you can't have a first-class economy when you have second-class citizens. So I think there's no question that sort of unfair treatment under U.S. law has contributed to some of the problems that Puerto Rico faces in its economy. So aside from questions of self-determination, questions of independence, Puerto Rico's people, I think, are negatively impacted economically by the island status as a territory. I think, you know, the Archbishop of San Juan, who we work closely with, Archbishop Gonzalez, wrote a really good article in The Hill recently where he said, you know, I support this bill because it's a necessary step to resolving our economic crisis, which is really a humanitarian crisis in a very short-term sense. He said, you know, the fact that this bill creates a control board to oversee Puerto Rico's finances, you know, the phrasing he said was it weighs heavy on my heart. And then he said, you know, but we have to address the fact that, you know, Puerto Rico's status is what it is. And if we want to change that, we need to start having that conversation. In the short term, we have to fix the economy. In the longer term, I think the question of Puerto Rico status is very much one that will need to be dealt with. And I think it needs to be dealt with in a way that allows Puerto Rico to have determination over its own economic future.
So when Senator Mitch McConnell says that this bill won't cost the taxpayers a dime, what it will do is help Puerto Rico restructure its financial obligations and provide much-needed oversight to put into place reforms. Obviously, we're living in this period of this sort of austerity. You mentioned austerity in Puerto Rico, which I'm sure is a hell of a lot more severe than it is here. But nevertheless, what's McConnell saying? There is actually no bailout. Is that what we're talking about here? It won't cost the taxpayers a dime?
Correct. Yeah, U.S. You know, U.S. taxpayers are not going to be paying to quote unquote bail out Puerto Rico. The bill just allows Puerto Rico a temporary respite from litigation and gives them a process that they can use tools basically to restructure their debt. So Puerto Rico is in limbo in terms of bankruptcy. You know, countries can't go bankrupt, but countries have access to emergency loans and programs from the International Monetary Fund and other institutions. States have access to Chapter 9 bankruptcy for their municipalities. So if you know, Michigan, for instance, was able to use that with Detroit, Puerto Rico has access to neither. It's not a country, can't get funding from the IMF, not a state, and it's exempted from or excluded, really, from U.S. bankruptcy law. So this bill is first and foremost about giving Puerto Rico a process so that it can begin to get out of debt. Because the alternative is, again, just a downward spiral where it can't deal with the debt, and the debt just continues to suck money out of Puerto Rico's social services and leads to really crippling austerity.
Well, of course, not only is Puerto Rico suffering from this debt crisis, Also, the Zika virus is a real problem now.
That's right.
in Puerto Rico, and that was the other bill that was in the Senate today. And it's sort of a contrast to here. Here you have the senators, Democrats and Republicans alike, voting to help debt relief for Puerto Rico, but at the same time, the Zika funding bill from the House, which is less than the $1.9 billion that the White House asked for, it's $1.1 billion, but the House Republicans attached a whole bunch of sort of riders to satisfy the furthest right wing of the Tea Party, for example, delaying a ban on flying the Confederate flag on federal buildings to placate reactionary Southern lawmakers, and an attack on Planned Parenthood over contraception, which, of course, in terms of Zika, women are afraid of getting pregnant, and it clearly the way to not get pregnant is to have some kind of contraception. So do you see that as a kind of an ironic contrast, that you've got dysfunction on the one hand and rancor and anger, Harry Reid basically saying that the House, you know, that in fact he said it's a giveaway to the crazies in the House on that bill, but they came together on this one. So I guess all is not lost. Is that the situation?
I think what you just went through highlights how remarkable it was that this bill was really has made it through to this point. There were so many opportunities where it could have been, for lack of a better word, hijacked or poisoned through some sort of amendment that would, lead others to not be able to vote for it. And the fact that it was shepherded through, I think there's a lot of credit that needs to go to specific lawmakers in both parties. Representative Duffy, Representative Pierluisi from Puerto Rico, and others who found a way to get it through. The Zika is a huge concern, and even in the midst of Zika, Puerto Rico slashed its health budget because it just can't afford to fund what it needs to fund. And so, if we want to stop Zika, Puerto Rico has to get out of debt so that it can fund basic services.
So just then, assuming that Puerto Rico survives this current crisis, it's still got a big hole to dig itself out of. What's your sense of going forward, whether there will be an attempt or an effort to address the underlying problems, which we discussed earlier, which is that Puerto Ricans are not full citizens of the United States, they don't have the a proper representation, and they don't have the proper protections under the Constitution?
Yeah, I think that's the great question. So, this bill is the first step. It's not the end. After this bill, the next step has to be comprehensive negotiations between Puerto Rico's governor and its creditors to resolve the debt crisis and restructure the debt in a way that's fair and that reduces poverty. And then after that, we have to start getting at the larger issues. So, or the longer term issues, I think that, several lawmakers have said that if anything, quote unquote good has come from this very bad crisis, it's that there may be renewed attention to Puerto Rico, as a place, as home to 3.5 million people who are our brothers and sisters, and fellow citizens. That there may be renewed focus on the question of Puerto Rico status and what that should be. And I'm hopeful that this can be a stepping stone to addressing that question as well. And I think also other questions, such as budget transparency and accountability, responsible lending, borrowing, those things need to be addressed in Puerto Rico's economy as it moves forward, so that we don't end up in this position again.
Well, Andrew Hanauer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Hanauer, who is the campaigns director for the Jubilee USA Network, where he represents Jubilee in policy meetings with the White House, Congress, the World Bank, the IMF, and other partner organizations. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.